Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Greetings, friends. It is I, D. Trussell, and this is an anomalous podcast intro. It's a Saturday morning, and it's raining outside. And the reason it's a Saturday morning is because yesterday was Friday, and these things keep happening. But also, the reason I'm recording this on a Saturday morning is because I spent all day yesterday after returning home from this glorious work that I'm involved in that I can't talk about yet. And I tried to record some kind of fancy podcast intro. Lots of bells and whistles. Tried to be funny. That's always going to be a disaster when you're trying to be funny. Just forget it. And also, was like putting a lot of icing in there. You know, that's just clearly a sign of something's off. If like, you know what I mean? You're making up for your lack of cake with too much icing, usually a sign that something is off. So simplicity is always the answer to those situations. And in this case, why am I trying to do some kind of fancy flowery podcast intro when I have one of the great meditation teachers alive today, who's written so many great books on this podcast? It doesn't make any sense. It's weird. So I figure, you know what? I'm just going to read this wonderful text I got today from Damien Eccles, who was on the podcast a couple months ago, I think. And what's kind of funny about this text is that it actually is the podcast intro, because it's a wonderful text about meditation. So I'm just going to read this text. I asked for his permission. He said I could. This is from his journal. Exactly how does magic work? To answer this, we turn to quantum physics. This particular field of science has discovered that we exist within a unified divine matrix. And the first law of how this matrix works is known as quantum entanglement. Quantum entanglement stipulates that all things which have been physically linked remain linked on an energetic level, even if they become separated by vast distances. Experiments have shown that by taking two photons, which have been linked and then separating them, we can still interact with one and have an effect on the other, even if it's nowhere near us. So how does this explain magic? Because at one point, the matter of which we are made was touching all other matter. In fact, it's said that if you removed all the empty space or dark energy of the universe, you could compress all the remaining matter in the entire universe into an area the size of a green pea, which is exactly the state we were in before the Big Bang. The matter of which we are made is entangled on a quantum level with the matter of everything else in existence. The implications of this are that by causing a change in ourselves, we also cause a change in the external universe. In fact, we now know this is true because of experiments which have shown that the universe is holographic, meaning that within each tiny piece of the universe, the reflection of the universe in its entirety can be found. What does this look like in a practical real-world scenario? For the answer to that, we can look at a study conducted by the World Peace Group. What they found was that by gathering enough trained meditators together in one place, they could create what they called the super radiance effect. Part of the super radiance effect was that war-related deaths in the surrounding area of Lebanon dropped by as much as 76%. Violent crime rates and even the number of house fires dropped dramatically. The experiment was conducted 7 more times over the next 2 years, while other possible influences such as holiday, the weather, etc., were all statistically controlled for. One thing they found was that the greater the number of trained meditation practitioners taking part, the greater the super radiance effect was. And as the number of practitioners taking part fell, the number of war deaths rose. The group began attempting to calculate just how many people in an area would need to practice some kind of technique that fills the practitioner with inner peace be it transcendental meditation, ceremonial magic, etc., they found that the answer was the square root of 1% of the population. This number was arrived at by another experiment conducted by the group in a Lebanese village called Basquinta. In Basquinta, as 1% of the population began practicing meditation, fighting stopped entirely. Now, I have not checked these sources or looked at how these studies worked, but I can tell you anecdotal evidence from my own life, which I've noticed, which is if I'm meditating, things do get way better. And I think maybe the way to look at that is instead of going into why that could be happening, though I love the quantum entanglement stuff, and I was just reading a tweet by Mitch Horowitz, another former guest on the podcast, who said that Sherman Helmsley from, what's that show, Moving On Up? What's it called? It's called The Jeffersons, and I loved it when I was a kid. But I had no idea that Sherman Helmsley was a disciplined follower of an ancient hermetic tradition that might have existed prior to the building of the pyramids. And it's all wrapped up in this book called The Kybalion. I'd heard about it, but I never spent any time with it. Wow, what a cool book. It has a lot of great ideas in it, a lot of very simple concepts that can become very complex. But one of them that I love is that opposites are actually the same thing at different degrees, which is crazy when you consider that. Meaning that if you have some kind of, I don't know, an aspect of yourself that you're not happy with, you could actually sort of connect, or you already are connected with that thing's opposite, because it's basically the same thing. If you're experiencing some kind of, confusion, for example, that confusion is actually the experience of dawning realization, because if you didn't have dawning realization, you wouldn't know you were confused. And similarly, this like happens in the natural world. For example, heat and cold, they're the same thing. It's just a continuum, you know, that we're all on. And so within these ideas are all these like potential things, potentialities, which is that you could theoretically like jump, so to speak, jump opposites. You know, I don't know if you saw Bandersnatch, the Black Mirror, the weird Black Mirror choose your own adventure thing on Netflix. Pretty cool. But there is like the kind of like, I don't know how many versions of the story there are, but I think there's this concept you could like jump through mirrors into alternate dimensions, you know? And when you're looking in a mirror, you're essentially seeing the opposite of you. I mean, it's you, but it's you in reverse. Left is right, right is left. This is like the, sounds crazy, but it's like, this is the, when you're watching a weatherman or woman, you're seeing someone who's like really good at doing everything in the opposite. Because the weather map that they're seeing is on a green screen and they're having to look at another thing. Anyway, I saw somebody do it at the CNN building in Atlanta. And then when I realized what they were doing, it was crazy. If I had to do that, I would simultaneously shit my pants, piss myself, probably have some kind of seizure and collapse. Regardless, there was this idea in Bandersnatch that you could jump from one into a mirror, into another dimension, which is where you would be living a completely different life and sort of travel through the Black Mirror, cynical, depressing, and annoying yet awesome multiverse. So similarly, this concept of opposites being the same thing on different levels has within it a weird potential for a kind of like form of mentation, a kind of like cognitive exploration of things that you thought you were disconnected from, but that you are completely connected to. And that wonderful text I got from Damien also has within it this idea of the kind of interconnectivity of all things, and how if you begin to meditate in whatever way that may be, because the meditation is just like a path, the destination or the sort of state it potentially could open up within you, that's It's like, you know, there's lots of ways to get bicep muscles. That's what I tell all the people I train at my private gym. And we, you know, some of my students, we lift, we lift like watermelons or like various types of fruit. Some of my students, we do kettlebells, and some of my students, I just fill their biceps up with a kind of mucus that forms muscles. But those are for the more advanced students, believe it or not. There's lots of ways to get biceps. Similarly, there's lots of ways to create some spaciousness within the medieval torture chamber you call your mind. Not that your mind is a medieval torture chamber, but sometimes I'm definitely putting myself on the rack. And when you achieve that spaciousness, it's not just as though suddenly you feel better. It's that those around you, that the things around you also begin to conform to that bigger space. And so that's the weird thing that I have definitely noticed that happens, which is when you start, you know, working out, meditating, jogging, whatever it is, if you start some consistent thing that runs counter to whatever particular pattern you're in that you don't like, it's not just like suddenly you start changing. It's like suddenly your luck gets a little better. Suddenly colors seem a little brighter. Suddenly people seem a little nicer. You know, it's like the radio station changes from some kind of sad, weird, industrial loop to something a little sweeter. And then, unfortunately, if you're me, you go back to the industrial loop and you keep doing that over and over again, which brings us to one of my favorite sayings, which emanated from today's guest, Sharon Salzberg, which is, the healing is in the return. It's okay if your pendulum is swinging to the opposite, if you find yourself going down degrees and up degrees and you feel a little woozy, it's okay. And Sharon has a real talent at expressing ways to sort of open up to that swinging pendulum that for some of us, sometimes we find ourselves sitting at a bar, and sometimes we find ourselves on a meditation cushion. Sometimes you're watching the Ted Bundy documentary on Netflix, which is awesome. And sometimes you're sitting in front of a candle watching your breath. And this pendulum is actually part of the process. But I don't want to spoil it for you. I would like to invite you to go to Sharon's website and sign up. I just signed up. I'm doing it this year. I've talked about this on the podcast in a previous year, and I didn't do it. This year, I'm doing it. Go to SharonSalzberg.com and sign up. If you're listening to this on the 2nd of February, there's 3 more days that you could sign up for this thing. And basically, we're going to meditate every day in February. And I don't know that I've ever pulled off an entire month of straight meditation. I'm going to admit that right now. I haven't done it. It's like, I'll get to a point where I'm like, I'm doing it. This is going to be it. This is it. But I'll always miss a day or two, which is fine. But this time, we're going to do it. We're going to win the meditation challenge. And our meditation biceps are going to be engorged and ripped. And then we can lay on the beach of enlightenment and make people jealous about our spiritual muscles. What a great podcast we have for you today. We're going to jump right into it. But first, some quick business. Robinhood is an investing app that lets you buy and sell stocks, ETF, options, and cryptos all commission-free. While other brokerages charge up to 10 bucks for every trade, Robinhood doesn't charge any commission fees, so you can trade stocks and keep all of your profits. Plus, there's no account minimum deposit needed to get started, so you can start investing at any level. The simple, intuitive design of Robinhood makes investing easy for newcomers and experts alike. View easy-to-understand charts and market data, and place a trade in just 4 taps on your smartphone. You can also view stock collections, such as 100 Most Popular. With Robinhood, you can learn how to invest in the market as you build your portfolio, discover new stocks, track your favorite companies, and get custom notifications for price movements so you never miss the right moment to invest. Robinhood is giving listeners of the Duncan Trussell Family Hour a free stock like Apple, Ford, or Sprint to help you build your portfolio. Sign up at duncan.robinhood.com. Thanks, Robinhood. Baby report. This is the part of the podcast where I'm going to report in on the baby, and he is adorable. He's beautiful. I can't believe I get to be hanging out with him. It's pretty incredible. And I never thought I'd be so happy at 5 a.m. in the morning holding a little baby. Seems to be not only causing my brain to release some kind of incredible blast of pure, sweet joy, but it's also teaching me about something I read in a book, of course. I mean, it wasn't on a bathroom wall, but it could have been. The book wasn't that long. The saying is, the great way is easy for he who holds no preferences. And that really applies to when you're hanging out with a baby, because if you've got something you want to do, some place you want to be, something that needs to get done, if you don't want there to be a sudden explosion of poop all over your shoes, or maybe you're hoping to get a little bit more sleep, you're gonna be hurting. But if you just sort of go into the moment with the baby, suddenly it's like you're in paradise. The other thing I figured out, well, I didn't figure it out. Who am I fooling? Erin, my wife, was a nanny for years. So she knows how to do this with babies. She's taught me a lot. One of the things is, with a baby, you have to roll their cigarettes extra small, because they're, just kidding. With a baby, you have to, you know, you should react to what's happening. Because when they're screaming, and this is what I was doing, when he's screaming, I would sing to him. Because I like singing to him. But when they're upset, you should acknowledge they're actually upset. So you, even though they don't speak English yet, you can talk to them and say, hey, I know you're upset. We're gonna get through this. Don't sing to them like some weirdo. She didn't tell me that. I just figured that out. I was thinking, you know, if I was a tiny little thing and I was legitimately freaking out, some weirdo with an ungroomed beard came and started singing some babbling song to me about clowns, it would not be a great way to start the morning. So that's something that I really like about having a baby, is it teaches you not just how important it is to be in the moment, but how important it is to save your clown songs for moments when somebody isn't screaming. That's the end of Baby Report. And now we shall blow the blessing horn. Every time we blow this, it causes over 5,000 spontaneous orgasms across the planet. You might be one of them. And also, it purifies you of all your dark past karmas and cleanses your Akashic record collection, which is filthy. So here we go, the horn of blessing. Also, there is under a 15% chance that when you hear the horn of blessing, you'll go permanently blind and insane. But it's the odds are not, it's 15, there's like, is it a 15% chance that it will happen, or is it more like an 85% chance that it won't, right? See, that's the best way to look at it. So here we go, the horn of blessing now. Oh boy, not the horn of blessing again. Guaranteed, if there was a horn of blessing, and some angelic being would blow it every 2 years, and it would cleanse all of the darkness from humanity, there would be at least 10 people who would be like, great, fucking horn of blessing. And who does he think he is blowing that horn? You can't just blow the horn of blessing. You can just cleanse Akashic records. You can't just blow the horn. It's dangerous to blow the horn. He's blowing it wrong. It's not the way the angels of the past blew the horn of blessing. What's happening? His horn blowing skills are not... Why? Who gave him the horn? There'd be news reports like, oh, what's happened to the horn of blessing angel? The new horn of blessing angel complaints surround the new horn of blessing angel. His blessing horn does not sound like the previous horns of previous generations. What's up with that angel? Well, I'm not an angel, and it's not a blessing horn. It's actually a hunting horn that was hanging above my father's bed where he died. This is his hunting horn. He wanted to die a wooden knight. So I like blowing his energy out into the universe because he was a really sweet, cool guy. Of course, I'm going to think that. He was my dad. But according to something I read on the wall of a bathroom, you're all my dad and my mom, and I love you. Speaking of dads and moms, there's something that connects dads and moms, and that thing is called, for lack of a better word, an erection. We need them. Behind every great human is their father's erection. These are words perhaps better left unspoken if you're erection phobic, or if you are someone who just teleported in off of the Mayflower from a more puritanical time in human history where the body was considered to be vulgar, but the reality of the situation is that anyone who is wobbling around on this wonderful planet was at least partially exploded out of an erection. And I hesitated, you know, I was like, oh man, I don't know. Should I do a Blue Chew commercial, but then also it's this great teacher. And is it blasphemous? And then I realized, what's wrong with you? Do you, you think the fountain of all existence is blasphemous? To quote George Washington, if boners are evil, I want to live on another planet. We're going to jump to this commercial and we'll be right back. This episode of the DTFH is brought to you by the Erection Wizards, Warlocks, Priestesses, and Shamans over at BlueChew.com. You can increase your performance and get extra confidence in bed. BlueChew.com, that's blue, like the color blue. BlueChew.com brings you the first chewable with the same FDA-approved active ingredients as Viagra and Cialis. So you know it's the real deal, and it's the stuff that works. You can take them anytime, day or night, even on a full stomach. And since they're chewable, they work up to twice as fast as a pill. So you can be ready whenever an opportunity arises. If you find yourself in an emergency situation that requires an expedient erection, Blue Chew's for you. Now, this isn't just for guys with dysfunction. It's for any guy who wants extra function and to enhance their performance in the bedroom. I'm not ashamed of science, friends. Am I gonna shake my fist at the very same process that gave us the moon landing and electricity? Heck no. I like boner pills, and I like being able to go online and talk to a doctor and get a prescription without having to drive anywhere. Also, I don't know, I like chewing my boner pills. I didn't know that until Blue Chew came along. And there's something visceral, primordial, in chomping up your boner pills like you're some ancient golem eating gold. Right now, we've got a special deal for our listeners. Visit BlueChew.com and get your first shipment free when you use our special promo code Duncan. You just pay $5 shipping. Again, that's BlueChew.com. And much thanks to the Lingam Alchemists over at Blue Chew. Much thanks to my Patreon subscribers. You can subscribe over at patreon.com/DTFH. We also have a shop located at duncantrussell.com with such beautiful merchandise, including our now famous Stop Drinking Crow's Milk stickers. And also, if you're someone who falls on the other side of the crow's milk continuum, We've got drinking crow's milk stickers over there. I have no opinion on this at all. I just want my family to be safe, and I don't have anything else to say about that is raging around our planet. Now, without further ado, everybody, please welcome to the Duncan Trussell Family Hour podcast, the author of such incredible books as Real Love, Loving Kindness, Real Happiness, Love Your Enemies, and Faith. She gives wonderful Dharma talks and lectures all over the planet. She's also got some great online courses on her website, and she's going to be at the Ram Dass Spring Retreat, which is coming right up. I'm going to be there too. You can find her by going to SharonSalzberg.com. And remember, if you're listening to this before February 5th, it's not too late to sign up for the month-long meditation challenge, which I will be taking. So now, everyone, please open your heart chakras and zing some love through whatever the dark matter is that is separating you from Sharon Salzberg and all of us from each other. And welcome to the Duncan Trussell Family Hour podcast, Sharon Salzberg. Okay. Sharon, welcome back to the DTFH. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much. It's been too long, I think.
It's been way too long. But you know how time works especially when it comes with like teachers and students. Forever reverberating in my mind is something you said to me at the Ram Dass retreat, mm-hmm. when I asked you if drinking whiskey and watching Westworld was a practice, and you said, it's a practice, but you're practicing the wrong thing.
Oh, good. I'm glad I was right in the moment. Well, there you go.
I think about it every time I drink whiskey.
Okay.
But I wanted to sort of circle around the concept of practice for our conversation today, because you have coming up your meditation challenge, which is something you do once a year. It starts on February 1st. I wonder if you could just give a synopsis of what that is.
Sure. Well, something like 7 years ago or so, I had a book come out called Real Happiness, which is, it's kind of a guide to starting a meditation practice or renewing one, maybe if you used to have one. And the full title was Real Happiness, The Power of Meditation, a 28-day program, and came out like in January or something. And Ambika, who was my assistant at the time, who was a mutual friend, said, why don't you do a challenge? Because February has 28 days. And I said, I don't think so. But she was totally right. We did it. And it was a beautiful expression. It was all on my website. So people were practicing every day. They were sharing their experience. Some people were blogging, some people were commenting, some people were just reading, but it formed this tremendous sense of community. As we asked everyone to be really honest, you know, I said, if you're not like sitting for 2 minutes and floating in the air, please don't say you are. You know? So we got really heart to heart to connect to one another. And I had done a series of guided meditations for this site called Happify, which has lent us each February the meditations. So everybody gets a guided meditation they can stream, like 3 months, I think, each day. And I write and people ask questions, and they also have ways of talking to one another. So it's a beautiful experience.
You did it because you chose February because it's the shortest month, because there's only 28 days?
Because it's the subtitle of the book. It's a 28-day program.
Oh, I gotcha. Yeah. there's something that I go back and forth on, and I wonder if you could help clarify it for me. It's something I heard Ram Dass say once regarding meditation. And he said, I don't often recommend it to people, that I don't want to tell people to meditate. Don't meditate. Just forget about it. Don't, you know, when you're right, when it's time to do it, you'll do it. But then whenever I have an actual consistent practice, things become so wonderful in my life that it feels really difficult to not start advising people about this experience. How do you think someone should go about conveying the idea that meditation is great without sounding like a jerk or without, you know,
you know, it's my livelihood. Well, you know, I think people are different, and I have the kind of mind where I'm very helped by structure. And so having a method, having a program, having a commitment, it needs to be a realistic one. Like, I'm not going to say I'm going to sit 8 hours a day for 40 years, you know, but it's more like 10 minutes a day for a month, or, you know, whatever proves to be realistic. That helps me enormously, because I'm the kind of person, if I said, you know, I think I'll practice 3 times a week, it'd be Monday, and I think I'll start Wednesday. And it'd be Wednesday, I think I'll do 3 times on Saturday, and I'd never do it.
Right.
But like, every day is every day, and it's just clear. And it also helped me tremendously with the very significant problem I had with self-judgment, because this is when I was living in India in the early 70s, and I wasn't always on retreat. Sometimes I was just living a life, and it was a very simple life, because there were no computers, there were no faxes, there were no cell phones, no one had a job.
Where were you in India?
Practicing and buying vegetables or something, you know.
Where were you in India, Sharon?
I was in India from basically...
Which part of India?
Oh, northern India. Well, I was practicing in the winters in Bodh Gaya, which is in the state of Bihar. And then it would get very, very hot. And so we would just go up to the mountains somewhere and then go back when we could. And so we'd rent a house in the mountains. We were just living together and cooking. And even in those situations, I found it was very hard for me to have a daily practice. And that's like without a job, without a computer, without a cell phone. And my problem really was judgment, because when I'd sit and it would feel lovely and I'd feel peaceful, I'd think, oh, good, I'm going to stay in India for the rest of my life feeling exactly like this. And when I was cranky or restless or bored or my knee hurt, I'd get up. I think it doesn't work. And I went to one of my teachers, a man named Manindra, and I described that pattern. And he said, for you, I have just one piece of advice, and that is just put your body there. He said, every day you put your body there. Some days it's going to feel one way, other days it's going to feel another way. That's not up to us, and it's not even always that significant, you know, because there's so much hidden going on and there's so much unknown going on, and we just have to do it and keep like putting our heart there and putting our energy there.
Have you ever watched the crystallization process, like crystals forming in liquid? Have you ever watched that?
Yeah.
It's a fascinating thing to watch, because there's so much beauty in crystals, snowflakes, so many patterns in crystals, and they just form. They don't, you know, whatever the substrate is the crystal's forming in isn't furrowing its brow to produce a perfectly unique and beautiful geometry. It just happens this way. Do you think meditation might be a little bit like that just sitting still for some reason is causing this kind of form to or something like that within?
I think definitely it sort of reminds me of the first time I ever walked a labyrinth. And I was actually in San Francisco at Grace Cathedral, and it was outdoors. So somebody had created these sort of stone sculptures that had formed a labyrinth, which I was just walking along. And of course, it's a pre-patterned walk. And with the goal, so to speak, of getting right into the center, right into the heart center of the whole maze. So I was walking along. There was one point where I was so close to the center. And then my path took me out almost to the edge. And I thought, oh, no, I must have made a mistake. But it's only like one step in front of the other. So I kept going. And I discovered that, to my surprise, having been so close to the center and then so far away, I just kept going. And then there I was, right in the center.
Right.
And, you know, I just experienced that for a while. And then I went inside where there was an identical labyrinth because it's the same pattern, but on a rug. And I started walking and I had the identical experience. I was almost in the center, then I was way out of the edge, and I thought, oh no, I must have made a mistake. And I thought, didn't you just have this experience like 5 minutes ago? You know, and sometimes our path is like that. Yeah. It can be very mysterious, and yet the call is to keep going, because otherwise it's just a story. You know, other people can do it and I can't do it, or I can do it next year when things are calmer, or
right.
You know, whatever it is, it's just a story we're telling. What we have to do is actually walk it. And again, it needs to be reasonable. You don't want to make some crazy commitment to something that's abusive or endless without seeing that kind of result. But once you have framed it in some way, then I come down on the side of having been very helped by a commitment to daily practice. And Ramdas, of course, had the guru whom he loved, you know, absolutely. Yeah. The thought of being coerced or forced would be so antithetical to that relationship.
Right, right. Okay, sure. That makes sense. That helps clarify that. Thank you. There seems to be something suspicious either about the human nervous system, our brains, our energetic systems, or the universe itself, that this thing that is so simple to do, which is to sit, I'm sitting right now, you're sitting right now, but you remove all the other stuff you might do while you're sitting so that you're just sitting, something like that would be so incredibly difficult to keep doing over time. It's beyond suspicious. It reminds me, I was playing a video game, and the character that I was controlling, it just hit a wall. You know, they didn't even try to explain why they couldn't go further. There's just an invisible barrier there. It's kind of bad game design. Similarly, there seems to be something fundamentally suspicious in the great difficulty of sitting still every single day. And especially when this act over time produces, and I almost feel guilty talking about production or result, as I've been taught that this isn't really the point necessarily. You can get caught in these things, but it does seem to produce better sleep, less anxiety, deeper connections with the people around you, a sense that you've haven't actually ever been alive, except now you're sort of alive, a feeling of being surrounded by a great deal of wisdom that you had been missing for a long time. And even though there is this realization of these things, and you think, oh, okay, this must be the thing they're talking about then. This must be some form of enlightenment. Oh, I'm the great meditator. The next day you're like, you know, I think I just want to play piano today. I don't want to go and sit. What is that?
Well, I think those results are worthy results. You know, I also don't come down on the side of there, you know, there's no goal or, I mean, you don't want to be obsessed with it, you know, because then you're never doing the thing. You're just thinking about what it's going to get you.
Right.
It's a waste of time. And also we reify the goal in such a way, like it's got to feel exactly like this. Like when I started practice, for some reason, I had this crazy idea in my head that good meditation meant being bathed in brilliant white light. I don't have any white light. I had some other beautiful experiences of love, and I had some really painful experiences that were super important, but I discounted everything because it wasn't white light. No one ever said I had to have white light, and it wasn't true, but I was fixated, you know, and that's how we get fixated on an experience. We say nothing else counts, and especially because we're so phobic about pain, and sometimes pain is important. And even waking up during neutral times is a big part of mindfulness. Like all the times we're just sort of, they're not very pleasant, they're not very unpleasant. We're kind of waiting for something better to happen. And we are half asleep, you know, we're not really alive. And so we want to be more present during every moment. And that's hard to believe when we get caught in that idea of what should be happening. But if you can unwind from that, then of course, I mean, you're putting effort into something. It has to be bringing some benefit. Another problem is that the real benefit and the kind of enduring benefit that comes from meditation practice happens in our life it's not necessarily captured in like a great breakthrough moment. You can't necessarily say at 11:14, I loved myself completely and it was never an issue again, you know, but
right.
You start to notice when you're in conversation with somebody or you're meeting a stranger or you just really made a mistake and how you speak to yourself, you start to think, I'm changing. This is different than it used to be. And even before that happens, oddly enough, sometimes it's someone else who says it to us. Like, you know, I have many people who come to me and say, you'll have this experience maybe someday, who come to me and say, I was going to stop meditating because I thought nothing was happening. And then my kids came to me and said, please don't stop. You're much better.
Wow.
You know, things like that. And, you know, not as kind of critical or quick to anger or more patient, really listening. Those things, that's why we practice in the end, is to have a different sort of life. And it really does have that effect. Why we resist it and we look the other way. And we're so conditioned, you know, it's got to feel a certain way. It doesn't feel that way, therefore it's no good. Or I can't really do it. It's too selfish. I hear that a lot. It's too selfish. You know, I should be taking care of others. I should be, my to-do list is insane. Why am I, you know, sitting and doing nothing? Or, you know, I mean, there are lots of reasons that we come up with, and it's a very strong reality.
It is a very strong reality. And that selfish idea, the idea that meditation, self-improvement, that form of self is selfish is really fascinating. It's also in that same box. You've got, well, if you love yourself, you must be narcissistic. You know, the other day I spontaneously told someone I like myself instead of, you know, saying, oh, I should say I like my, I actually meant it. And I couldn't believe it. I was like, oh, wow. It just came out of my mouth. This is incredible. Holy crap. This is incredible. And then I apologized. I'm sorry. I can't help it. I felt weird and guilty. But it's interesting to me because meditation seems to be the opposite of selfishness. It seems to be that the problem is one of selfishness in the sense that we are compressed into these identities in such a tight way. You know, like when you're in too small an apartment with roommates, it's the worst situation.
Yeah.
But the human body is such a tiny little apartment if that's all you think you are, and you're stuck in there with yourself.
I know, all the time.
And you're not going to work. You're working from home. You're always there, you know. And so within this situation, this compressed situation, there is it's fundamentally a selfish predicament. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the phenomena of the self and how you, after so many, many years of a practice, how you what you consider yourself to be.
Well, you know, a lot of the languaging and sort of the poetry and the imagery of some of the spirituality I encountered in India, not really within the Buddhist context, which is different, but there's a lot about killing the ego and annihilating the self. And I was kind of scared. I thought, that doesn't sound that good, you know?
Yeah.
There was this little part of me that had been with me all the time that I was now going to, you know, annihilate. It didn't really feel good. But I mean, within the Buddhist perspective, it's not that at all. It's sort of like the way we hold ourselves, the story we tell about who we are, the conceptualization we have, that's what's wrong. So we consider ourselves very separate. We consider ourselves really isolated. We consider ourselves all powerful. Even though we meet the evidence moment after moment, I couldn't decide what thought to have. It just came. I couldn't keep sleepiness at bay. I couldn't say to myself, you've grieved enough, it's done, or you'll never be afraid again. But we believe that we should be in control because that's what we're taught, and that's reinforced all the time. So we tend to see the self as solitary, as in control, as disconnected, like independent and disconnected. And what the whole spiritual path ultimately comes to is seeing, having a sense of self that's more intertwined, or it's about interbeing. So it doesn't negate the individuality, which is what people also forget about. Like people say, well, if there's no self, how am I going to walk out of the room? And the idea is there's never been a self. in that old way of holding it. So you walked into the room, you'll be able to walk out. And be able to, you know, somebody once pointed randomly to someone in the room and said, "Well, if there's no self, how come she's not doing my taxes?" You know? You know, we are individual, and yet we are also connected. So a common example would be like if you go out and you look at a tree, it's a tree, and it's just there. It's like an entity, and that's true. But there's also a way of looking at the tree and sensing the soil, which is nourishing it, and everything that affects that soil, and which means like the rainfall, and everything that affects the rainfall, which we now know is kind of vast expanse of things, and you know, the sunlight and the moonlight and the quality of the air and who planted the tree. And you get to see the tree as a network of relationship, right? That is also part, it's a pattern of life coming together right there. So it's a tree on one level, and on another level, it's a network. And that's true of us as well. So more and more over time, I see that interconnection is the opposite of the kind of old egoic solitary idea of self, but we tend to fear that the opposite of that idea is like a blank, you know, and that either we all become a soup and there's no individuality, or we've killed ourselves in some way, and it's not that appealing. I think it's important to actually understand that and to look at things in the light of interconnection. The Vietnamese Zen master Thich Nhat Hanh, he does this exercise, or did this exercise, we like hold up a string bean and say, "Now see the world." You know, and you start thinking about the sun, you know, and, you know, everything that is happening in that string being coming. It's all about connection. It's about relationship.
Why is something that is so obvious, that it's been scientifically verified, that everybody kind of knows on an intellectual level, why is something like that a thing we have to learn and not a thing that we just naturally are human beings as a species malfunctioning, or are we malfunctioning, or is it just that we are sort of slowly growing into a different identity than the one that we currently seem to be stuck in, and it does seem like that fixation is somewhat catastrophic right now.
Yeah. Well, that's a very interesting question. Of course, it's much nicer to think we're growing into it, isn't it?
Yes, yes.
Oh, that's so much nicer. I think I'll think that way from now on.
Okay, me too.
Thank you so much. I mean, I don't really know. You know, the whys are difficult. I also had a teacher in India who was very much trying to help us move from only asking why to just saying what, like what's happening right now. Because not that you never ask why, but we were very fixated on that. And his point was that if you're asking why, you're always going to involve a belief system, which means someone else's vision of what's true. And it will be different. If you say, "Why am I experiencing this?" to a Jungian therapist, they might have one response. And if you take that very same experience and go to a Freudian therapist, they might have another response, or a scholar of this or that, or my sort of, funniest experience of that was in India, you know, with some teachers who were very, very in the kind of classical mode of Buddhist cosmology of, say, rebirth and many lives and having been many things in many lives. And other teachers I had would say, "You don't have to believe that. You know, the whole point is the method and your own awareness and practice, and you don't have to just..." And that my funniest teacher was probably Manindra, who said, "You don't have to believe it. It's true, but you don't have to believe it." You know, so, okay, I'm not going to deal with it. But I once asked somebody, a teacher, because I had quite significant physical pain as well as emotional pain when I was first starting to practice. And I said, "Why? Like, why do I have so much pain? Nobody else seems to have so much pain as I do." And he said, "Well, you must have tortured many small animals in a previous life."
Wow.
And then I felt, needless to say, not only did I have pain, I felt like the slimiest person on earth. You know,
that right.
Animals, little animals, like little baby animals. But in that context of that cosmology, that made a certain amount of sense. You're working off a kind of karma that you created by
sure.
doing this thing. And I thought, that's not useful, actually, for me. you know, it's not a helpful context.
I see what you're saying. Yeah, sure. I remember you at one of the retreats. I think you were talking about add-ons.
Yeah.
You know, the problem of just the way that we seem to have some phenomena, we experience some phenomena in the moment and then create an infinite story around that phenomena. Yeah. And I guess metaphysically, that's an add-on, the reincarnation stuff.
Yeah. I mean, unless it's useful for you. You know, it's fun to sort of see, like, what you just did. Like, you reframed everything for me instead of being sort of doleful, you know. It was like, oh, we're getting better. You know, so it's useful to see the add-on as an add-on and just to play, you know.
Yes.
When I reverse it, whoa.
Right. Well, I do, you know, to defend my whyingness.
Okay.
I think that the enlightenment of the Buddha is a thing that some people think of as like something that happened in antiquity. And people have all kinds of ideas about it. Mm-hmm. But sometimes I think this was some kind of nuclear bomb that went off. Mm-hmm. And I think it has barely, the first shockwave hasn't even, hasn't even gone around the planet yet. That it's just happening right now. And I think that for whatever reason, it took a little bit longer to get to the West. But it's starting to sink in a little bit. And maybe the reason that it's took longer to get to the West is because the West seems to be more fixated on the stories and on the identity or the ego and the stories surrounding the ego. So I sometimes think, oh, is this just the same thing that happens when, you know, over the course of millennia, a thing suddenly begins to develop an optic nerve, for example. Like, in this case, it's odd because it seems like humans have created illusionary appendages, the past and the future and all the stories about what we are, and have ignored the only appendage, which seems to be the present moment, which makes us a really clumsy and sad creature in that sense. So, yeah, sometimes I do get this feeling of, I wonder if this is like that there is actually the potential for what so many embarrassing people have bugled out about, the age of Aquarius, the coming age of realization, the Maitreya, the second coming of Christ, the singularity, so many different names for it. Do you have anything to say about that? Because that is a part of Buddhism, which is a mapping out of time. And from what I've read, we're in the state that sucks right before things get really wonderful.
I think it could be possible. I'm a New Yorker. It's a little hard for me.
Look at the subways. How can you say that? Have you never been on the subways? They don't work anymore.
Yeah, they're just here. I mean, it's really tough. And, you know, I don't know where I was teaching somewhere. I think just now Puerto Rico. I just came back from Puerto Rico. And I was saying, you know, in New York, it's like if you get into an elevator with somebody, at least when I was growing up here, you don't look at them, you don't smile at them, you kind of turn around, you don't talk to them. People were looking at me like, ooh, tough, you know, that's tough. I don't know if I, you know, it's so warm, you know, gracious and generous.
Yeah.
I think there is room certainly to believe that because, I mean, also we have to think of who has told our story so far, you know, the story of evolution. And you don't hear a lot about, you hear a lot about survival of the fittest. You don't hear a lot about tend and befriend.
Yes.
Which is an alternative response to the amygdala taking over and fight, flight, and freeze. And, you know, it doesn't get a lot of airtime, but it also exists. And
you know, Sharon, someone just told me this, and I didn't verify it, so I don't know if it's true, but apparently Darwin talks about love hundreds of more times than he talks about survival of the fittest. But that's what we grabbed onto. Similarly, in Buddhism, I'm working with David Nichtern right now, and sometimes he talks about how people really seem to be fixated on the first two noble truths. Mm-hmm. Suffering, because we know that. And then the end of suffering, that's one that seems to get ignored quite a bit. So, yes, Darwin apparently did spend a lot of time talking about love, but what does that even mean? And how you can't sell missiles if you're talking about love or prisons.
Right. But if we don't realize the potency of love, we think it's something stupid and something sentimental, because that's what we've been taught. Right. Most people, maybe it's changing with age, but I would venture a guess that more people are taught it's a dog eat dog world than are taught about the power of love.
That's right.
And so if you don't understand that it's potent, it's real, it's important, and you don't understand it's a training, you think, well, some people got it and I didn't, I'm out of luck.
Right.
Then we're not going to do the things we can do to really change the world. And I think we can change the world.
You mean a training? What do you mean by a training?
Well, that's what, when I started teaching loving kindness practice in the West, no one else I knew was really doing it. And it was a little bit controversial and largely around those two points. One is, well, that's stupid. What I say these days is that's kind of a girly practice, It's just like sentimental and, gooey and
right.
Ignoring real pain and being conflict avoidant and ignoring some real problems and just covering it over with this goo. But the other point was that people didn't believe you could grow in love. You could be more right. loved, that you got a dose, maybe childhood, I don't know what, but, or it was like grace. It would just come upon you and that there's nothing you could do. And, of course, the Buddhist perspective is totally the opposite. It's a training, like it's an education. It's a training in awareness, paying attention differently. It's like, well, this is a little bit like what you're saying before. If you think about yourself at the end of the day, you only think about the mistakes you made and the problems you have and nothing good, that's going to form a reality for you, a world. But if you give a little air time to like, did anything else happen today? Is there good within me? It feels like disgusting thing to do, but it's not pretending, it's not being hypocritical, it's saying, I only go there pretty much as a matter of routine. What about a fuller picture of my day? What about a fuller picture of who I am that admits both things, the joy and the sorrow and all of that? That's the truth of things,
the truth.
Broadening to, we pay attention to the good, to the great things that come upon us, to the joy, as well as the power of just reaching out and having someone not feel so alone, even if you can't fix their problem. They don't have to feel all alone in it. And, but we realize, this is like a training, this is moving out of one's comfort zone and taking a few risks and awareness. And that's what the training means.
When did love become synonymous with weakness?
Well, that's an interesting question. I don't know. I guess I should be reading mid-Victorian novels or something.
I can't. I think that there seems to be something so backwards right now when it comes to love or the contemplation of love. Mm-hmm. And it's insane that people don't think this is a thing that can be developed, or they think that they could just be good at it right away. The greatest of things. Everyone talks about, love, 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 the greatest of things. But you imagine that you're just sort of born with this ability. My baby can't even burp, but love is there. There is love. There's love beyond love. There's the most amazing love ever. But then this is a love that is at this moment sort of based on a phenomena. And if love is based on a phenomena, then we're in trouble because now we've got this nipple, so to speak, that we're suckling love from. In this case, a baby. And if that's the case, oh my God, what are we all going to have babies so we can experience love? Are we going to use babies like nitrous oxide canisters at a Grateful Dead concert? Or are we just going to have babies scattered around when they start growing up? Forget it. No more love. It's a teenager now. Send it to the send it to prison. You know,
I can hardly wait.
Oh boy, so much karma I'm gonna burn off when Sweet Forest becomes a teen. But what I mean is this: there seems to be so many misconceptions about love. One, it's romantic, that it's flowery, that it's perfumey, oozy, that it's something temporary, and certainly something that happens just by luck. You turn the corner and there he is. There she is. There it is. Oh my God. So I would love it if you could talk a little bit about the basics of cultivating love. But maybe before that, if you could give your definition of what love is.
I think my definition these days is really connection. It doesn't mean liking somebody. It doesn't mean approving of them. But it's having some fundamental sense of connection that our lives have something to do with one another. And even if, and it doesn't mean a certain action. It doesn't mean I'm going to invite you to dinner or spend any time with you. But in my heart, you know, I can wish you to be free of suffering. I can wish you to be happy. And that sense of connection, it can expand, you know, quite considerably too. In a funny way, we're all in this together. It's like we don't easily live in a time where you can just silo off somebody and say, well, what you do over there doesn't matter.
Right.
Here, because it's going to affect me over here. And we do live in an interconnected universe. That's why it's powerful, because it's true. You know, that's how things actually are. And so I would say connection. And one, maybe the most startling change in view about love that I've had and I've seen is that it's not external to us. It's ours. You know, I, like everybody, you know, so strongly had a view of love as almost like a commodity in someone else's hands.
Right.
And if they chose to give it to me, there would be love in my life. But if they chose to take it away in whatever form, like maybe your kid, you know, is not going to want to be a scientist. They're going to want to be a musician, or maybe the other way around with you.
Yeah.
You
know?
Yeah. It's frustrating.
Yes, it will be.
Then it feels like, wait, you're taking away the source of love and bereft. I don't have that anymore. But
right.
I saw a movie, I don't know, it's like 11 years old by now, something like that. And my goddaughter was a chick. She had a tiny little part in it. She was a little girl, but she didn't speak. She barked because it was a talent show. That was her audition, was to bark. And it was a movie called Dan in Real Life. And one of the characters in the movie said, love is not a feeling, it's an ability. Love is not a feeling, it's an ability. And of course, it is also a feeling, but I was captivated by this notion of love as an ability because it so resembled experiences I had had doing meditation where, I mean, the image I use is like, you know, it was almost like the UPS person was standing at my doorstep with a package of love and looked down at the address and said, I don't think so, and started walking off. I said, wait a minute, and I have nothing. But really, love is inside of us. It's an ability. It's a capacity. And some people or situations or art or many things may like spark it and enhance it or threaten it. But it's ours. It's ours to cultivate. It's ours to recognize. You know, it's a very different picture than what we grow up with, most of us.
It absolutely is. And it's also outside of us, though, isn't it? I mean, isn't the is it the in Buddhism, doesn't the inside and the outside, aren't these sort of terms of convenience in relation to the reality of things, which is there just seems to be some kind of fundamental goodness to reality?
Yeah, no, I think that is true. And it's almost more like we so exclusively tend to think of it as outside of ourselves, in the hands of another. Like, what if they leave me? What if they don't like what I wrote? What if they, you know, criticize me? You know, then I have nothing. And to realize that we respond to people with appreciation, with compassion, from within, that there's a wholeness within us that other people may bring forth, or people can threaten us, you know. There's some really nasty people in this world too.
Yeah.
But we don't have to hold this hatred in our hearts for them.
Yeah.
We have this capacity, no matter what, to have love.
What I love about meditating and the exploration of the self, or just following the breath and all the things that seem to go along with that, the byproducts of that, you know, watching your breath, you realize, oh, I'm not really in control of my breath. It just seems to do its own thing. Mm-hmm. And then your thoughts, of course, mindfulness. It's like, I'm certainly not making these thoughts, or I hope I'm not. I'd be so embarrassed and bummed by some of them. So these are just seem to be bubbling up. And obviously, like the external stuff, if you think you're controlling the wind, holy shit, you're out of your mind, you know? Mm-hmm. But then also, you know, what's going on with your lungs and within you. And it gets to the point where you start running into a really perplexing place where it's like, wait, the birds are the same as my thoughts. The birds are in the trees like my thoughts are in my mind. They both of these things are doing their own thing. Where am I? Mm-hmm. And so then somewhere within that, the nasty people, where are they? What is that? If there doesn't seem to be any kind of selfness in the normal sense of the word and within me, where is it in the people who are nasty? What is that? The growling people, the people who are manipulative, the people who are devious, the people who are devious and manipulative in the same way that you've had a lifetime of practice cultivating love and kindness. Some people have a lifetime of practice cultivating, manipulating and exploiting and hurting. What is that? Is that a reflection? Is that a reflection of something? Is it a malfunction? Is it a distortion? What is that?
Well, it's a distortion. That's a good word for it. I think it's, I go back to the Buddha saying that everybody wants to be happy. And not happy in a superficial sense. We want a sense of belonging. We want a sense of being at home somewhere in this body, in this mind, with one another on this planet.
Right.
We all want that. And we are also very ignorant often about, we don't often have a clue about where real happiness is to be found. And we are taught so many things, including outright lies, you know, about where happiness will be found. And we're taught them again and again and again. And so we do absorb that, and we do believe it. And people do, you know, the most insane things to try to be happy because they think it will make them happy. And because we're not in the habit of introspection, of really taking a look, you think, oh, that hurt, you know?
Yeah,
I thought that was great. It was so free. It was so amazing, you know? Look at that. Look how lonely I am now. Or, you know, look at how I alienated all these people, or I diminished them in some way, and now I have, you know, it's just like, so it's a combination, I think, of the ignorance and then not looking to see the results. And so, but we can really see what's really hard, I think, for people, including me, is that, you know, when we look at ourselves, when I look at myself, and I loved your sequence of words, like growling, nasty, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
You know, it does come from a place of pain in me, you know, not believing I'm worth anything, or not believing in the consequences of action, or, you know, things don't matter, or whatever it is. It's some real ignorance. But you look at some other people, and somebody asked me this question once, I was on a panel. They said, look at these people who are causing so much harm in this world, and they don't look like they're suffering. They look pretty self-satisfied. You know, he said, if I could all, and I said, I agree, you know, that's hard for me too. So then they started fraying at the edges. I think, oh, good, you know, I can have compassion for you.
Bleeding eyes. Just one bloody tear every once in a while, please. That would help so much. A tooth falls out. Some kind of just like, you know, a slow motion. The same thing that happens to vampires in movies, when the light shines. Just a slow motion disintegration of evil would be amazing. But yeah. But, you know, of course, I have, as I'm rolling through my mind, I can't bring up one single person who's an obvious jerk that actually seems happy. Like maybe, you know, you watch like your favorite, like hyper conservative polemicist, whoever it may be, or hyper-leftist, watch a, just a someone who's getting paid to get pissed off and say scandalous things. They don't look happy. In other words, having a baby is great because I could just think, would I want them to hold my baby? You know what I mean? You, I wish I could hand the baby to this. I would love for you to hold the baby. Sean Hannity? No, I would not want him to hold the baby.
Yeah, that's
you know? Right. So I think, you know, there's some power in them. There's some in them. But they don't have enough power that they would make you want to be, want them to hold the most precious thing there is. So I don't know if that's necessarily bloody tears, but it's pretty embarrassing if people don't want you to hold their baby.
I think that's beautiful. Can I quote you?
Yes, absolutely. Thank you. I would love that. But Sharon, I there's something I wanted to talk with you about. And it's so I was, you know, as I was getting ready to chat with you and time went by so fast, we only have about 10 more minutes.
Yeah.
I became really fascinated with Deepa Ma.
It's so beautiful.
And I started researching her, and I just wondered if I could ask you a few questions about your experience with her.
That would make me so happy. You know, she's the person who told me to teach.
Yes, I do. Yes, I do know that. And I remember we talked about that in an interview, and then so I wanted to look deeper into what mm-hmm. she was talking about, and I was really thrilled to find out that, because now I have a real, you know, not that there aren't real families, but now I have I guess you could say a typical family structure. And she's considered the patron saint of householders, from what I read. Now, mm-hmm. I just want to, hopefully this will work. I'm going to try this. I found this online. Are you seeing that? That image on the screen, do you see that? See, I knew that would happen. Hang on, Sharon, sorry. Sharon, can you hear me? Ah, bummer. Okay, hang on. Can you hear me, Sharon?
Yes.
Did you hear me when I was showing you that image?
Yes.
Okay, I don't know what's happening. For whatever reason, the audio just doesn't translate into the next place. I don't want to mess with it because who needs the images? I can put them up later. It doesn't matter. Okay. But so I was really fascinated by her because she seems to be this connection for some of the, you know, great Buddhist teachers of the West right now. Mm-hmm. Joseph Goldstein, Jack Kornfield, Sharon Salzberg. If you haven't heard of her, you should. She's wonderful. You should look into her. and what I found specifically wonderful about her was it seems like she was teaching a kind of that there was no boundary between formal meditation and life.
Mm-hmm.
And that the quote, and I'm going to read it and I'll pop right back so we can hear you talk about it. The quote that I found, and I assume there would be sound in the next frame, so my apologies for this, but I'll just read I'm going to read this quote. Can you still hear me, Sharon?
Yeah.
Oh, perfect. Okay. If you are busy, then busyness is the meditation. And when you do calculations, know that you are doing calculations. Meditation is always possible at any time. If you are rushing to the office, then you should be mindful of rushing. Deepa Ma. Now, does that also mean that when I'm drinking whiskey, I'm meditating?
You're practicing something.
I'm sorry. But can you talk a little bit about this? Because I love it, but it seems like an easy way to trick yourself into thinking you're meditating. You know, what you said to me really hit home. It was a kind of wrathful thing to say in the best possible sense of the word. And it worked. It burned into me. And I'm so happy that I practice now. And I don't think that I do. I'm not at the point of realization where I can say, oh, yes, this is meditating too. This is meditating. This is meditating. Some things don't seem like that at all. So I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the positive side of this, and also the way you get caught in that kind of thinking.
Yeah. Well, I mean, one actual translation of the word that we translate usually as meditation. The word is bhavana, B-H-A-V-A-N-A, in like a Pali, the language of the original Buddhist text. It means cultivation. So yes, if you're drinking whiskey and watching something on TV, you are cultivating something.
Right.
It's a meditation, but is it what you want to be cultivating?
Right.
You know, right. And there's a certain point where we have to use the circumstance we are in. And that may be that you're very busy. Maybe you don't have much time to sit down formally and close your eyes. And you can certainly use those situations. And they're creative and they're important. And it's part of bringing things into your life. But people do actually misuse that. Not deep and wide, of course, you know, but I've heard it many times. The most uncharming way is probably, I was teaching a class in New York and somebody said, a lot of younger meditation teachers than you say you don't have to do a formal period of practice every day. So,
oh, man.
What do you think? So from my dotage, I said, well, you know, I think theoretically that is true. And it's really a theory. That is really a story we tell. It can happen and it needs to happen. You know, riding the subway, meeting a stranger, thanking somebody on the street, being asked for money on the street, holding your baby, you know, your baby's not sleeping, you know. We want to be able to bring more balance, more awareness, more love, more compassion to cultivate those states in every one of those circumstances. But what's going to make that easiest and what's going to make that real? You know, right. There was a contemporary of Deepa Maz who, she wasn't actually my teacher, but she was a teacher and also a Bengali woman and who'd been put in an arranged marriage, which was part of Deepa Maz's story. And, but she had a different story. She had very tyrannical in-laws and this other woman, and they'd never let her formally meditate. They'd never let her go off on retreat. And yet she grew and advanced and became a teacher. And so people used to ask her, how did you do that when you couldn't go on retreat? And she'd say, I was very mindful stirring the rice.
Wow.
And I knew the difference between her and me is that she really was very mindful stirring the rice. It's what she had.
Right.
Her intention to grow and understand was so strong. Whereas I could say very glibly, well, everything's meditation, you know, and I'm mindful stirring the rice. But am I really mindful stirring the rice? Probably not.
Right.
Email or something. And so to only practice without some kind of basis in a more formal practice is probably the hardest thing of all. It's doable and it's important to look at. But if you can have both, how great is that, you know?
Right.
I've read
some stuff about it and what comes across over and over again is it is like just what you're saying. It's possible in the way some 4-year-olds play Beethoven on the piano. It happens, but you go and play the piano and see how it sounds. And if it's not Beethoven, don't act like it is, right? It's more like that. But then as I was researching Deepa Maz, I wonder if you could talk about this or we could wrap up on this question. And it's a kind of frosting style question, but it's something that I'm interested in. In Buddhism, I have noticed that there does seem to be a mystical quality to it. And that there, I've had my experiences that I don't want to talk about right now just because I don't understand them at all. And I don't like, I don't, I'm doing the Chogyam Trungpa disowning thing, so to speak. So whatever. But then there does seem to be this sort of secret in Buddhism. I don't know if you'd even call it a secret or, I mean, it's out there, but you know what I mean? It's not what they focus on. Mm-hmm. It's not even mentioned. It's usually just, you know, go practice, watch your breath. And then within that some things can happen that I've read about. Merging with the Buddha mind, so to speak. Potentially some kind of experience that might seem to be like making a connection with a higher self, so to speak. Mm-hmm. Or you know, it's so funny. If you say, you know, I went and meditated and had an experience of hearing or connecting with some kind of angelic form, people are like, watch out, man. Are you okay? If you're like, I smoked DMT. And I talk to entities. They're like, cool, that's awesome, right? But if you do it, it's like, so, but with yeah. Buddhism, and it's really sort of, this stuff gets strangely swept under the rug. So I was reading the Wikipedia of Dipoma, and it said that she was demonstrating miracles, that she had been studying a style of Buddhism that had within it some kind of esoteric, mystical, magical lessons or stages, and that she would, which as it described in Wikipedia, it's just Wikipedia, so who knows, walking through walls, flying through the air, I believe, was there were some others, but those are the two that stuck out. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Said somewhere she could take a potato and bake it in her hands and make it taste like chocolate. I thought that was pretty cool.
Whoa. I will take that over walking through walls. We have doors. But can you talk a little bit about this? Yeah. Did you witness anything like that?
I never saw her do it, but it certainly was discussed. I mean, I wouldn't call it esoteric exactly. You know, it's like the definition of normality in a lot of the Asian worlds is very different than ours. It's much broader than ours, you know? But there are practices and there are ordinary practices, but she was really good at them. Maybe the best way of describing it is within any kind of Buddhist approach, there are certain practices that rest primarily on the strength of concentration. I'll describe that in a minute. And then there are practices that rest primarily on the strength of mindfulness. You know, like David Nichtern may have different vocabulary for this, but it's there somewhere. So concentration is just gathering our scattered energy and awareness together. You know, so you're aware of the breath and your mind is, you know, all over the place and you look back, right?
Yep.
And if you do that enough, your mind gets very focused. It's like the energy of the universe becomes available to you. And there are certain experiences you can have if you only did that, if you only kept coming back to the breath and back to the breath, which are called jhana. It's like sometimes it's translated as trance, which isn't right. It's like altered states of consciousness that are extraordinary. So if you pursue only that and you're just gathering all this energy in it and laying claim to it, then that's said to be the path to psychic power. What most teachers do, and it's sort of in the Buddhist framework, is you practice that a little bit, as we do. And when you get concentrated enough, you more start paying attention to a wider array of experiences, physical pain and pleasure and, you know, sorrow and joy and, you know, all the different things that are coming up, restlessness and calm. And you're just opening your awareness so that what you're looking at is the kind of the changing nature of all those things. And you're almost looking at change itself. In the end. So that's why mindfulness, which is that more open awareness, is said to lead to wisdom or insight, whereas only concentration will lead to power. You know, I mean, if you're only practicing concentration, right, it's not going to necessarily make you more loving. It's not going to make you wiser, but it will make you more powerful. So then there are ways of practicing. Manindra was also Dipama's teacher when she was in Burma, and she got to be a Dharma student, you know, through incredible painful suffering. She was in an arranged marriage, but when she was like 12, I think, but she and her husband fell very deeply in love, and then they didn't have children for about 18 years, which was considered her problem and a disgrace. Her husband really loved her and he didn't want to like get another wife. And then they had three children, two of whom died.
Oh.
And, they were living in Burma at the time. They're Bengali, but her husband was in the civil service. They were living in Burma. And one day he came home from work. He wasn't feeling that well, and he died by that night. So she was completely overcome by grief, and she developed a heart condition. She couldn't get out of bed, and she still had Deepa. Deepa Ma is like a nickname, Deepa's mother. She still had Deepa to raise, but she couldn't get out of bed. And the doctor came and said, "You're actually going to die of a broken heart unless you do something about your mind. You should learn how to meditate." So she got up, she got out of bed, and the meditation room was on what we would call the second floor. And they said she was too weak to actually walk up the stairs. She had to crawl up the stairs to get to the meditation room. And she practiced. And when she came out, it's like somehow she had metabolized the terrible suffering into compassion. And she was a beautiful, compassionate person, although fierce. It's like when you were talking earlier that, you know, you sit with her and she said, no naps, like you sit, you know?
Right.
Like, she was very fierce, but she was incredibly kind and loving. And I saw her with all kinds of people, and she never deviated from that because she knew, like, anyone's life could change on a dime. You know, you pick up your phone and you have a different life than the one you had before 2 seconds ago.
Right.
And she knew that. Everyone was included in that kind of compassion. So way back at that time, Meninja was her teacher in Burma. And he decided he wanted to take out some of the ancient texts that talk about how to develop those powers and see if it was true. So she had phenomenal concentration, so he tried it with her. And it's something like, you know, in those cultures, they consider physical phenomena to be earth, air, water, fire, and space. And she could focus so strongly, say, on space. They said she could see the space between the molecules and the wall. She just goes through.
Wow.
Or, you know, it's interesting because I have friends who are so upset about that. And they would say, did you see it? And I said, no, I didn't see it. But if they hear a story about Neem Karoli Baba, who didn't do that necessarily, but could say to, like he said to a friend of mine, and this is, you know, it was so long ago, there were no cell phones. This was the era when if you wanted to call someone in the States, you had to go to a city like New Delhi and go to an international hotel and book a trunk call for 24 hours and then,
wow,
you know, pant and then scream into the phone. So,
yeah,
you know, a friend of mine was there once, and Maharaja Neem Karoli Baba got everyone else to leave except this guy and his wife. And on Monday, he said to him, you should call your mother. Your family needs you. So then they had to go from, like, Brindaban to New Delhi, check into the hotel. And 24 hours later, he was talking to his mother, and his mother said, oh, thank God the State Department found you.
Wow. Right? Yeah.
And so I asked these friends who were very upset. I said, do you believe that? And they said, oh, yeah. You know, and I said, why do you believe that and not someone being able to walk through walls? And they said, because one is the mind and the other is like physical reality.
Yeah.
I said, no, is that different? You know, like, you know, it would seem to me that's a very impressive accomplishment to be able to look at somebody and say, call home, you know, out of nowhere.
Right.
You know, the world is just bigger and stranger than we take it to be. So I just think of her sort of psychic attainments in that light. You know, like, I didn't see them. People I trust saw them, like Meninja, who trained her in them. And at the same time, they were so not what you think about. Like, I never think about her baking a potato in her hand. You know?
Right.
Making it taste like chocolate. I think about her telling me to teach. I think about how loving she was, you know?
Well, and also, you know, what's so funny about these miracles, and I think I understand why not, I think, because I think personally it would be impolite for someone to demonstrate that to me at this moment in my life. It would throw me off if I saw someone walk through a wall. I'd never stop talking about it. It would be ridiculous. And I would also probably always have bloody noses from trying it myself. So it'd be...
Find the space between the molecules.
But also, there is something to me that is spectacularly miraculous about the fact that I'm talking to you right now using this incredible technology. And probably the reason that I'm having not only having this conversation with you, but also that my life is fundamentally improved because of a couple of sentences you said to me, mm-hmm, was because of your encounter with this person.
Totally. And
that's way better than a chocolate potato or walking through walls. I can get a chocolate potato, theoretically. I can go make one in the kitchen. And I can, if I want to walk through a wall, I can do it. I have a door. It separates different areas in the house. So I think that's something that gets really overlooked with these people. Everyone's like, holy shit, they knew that. They said, go call that person. But they don't even think about, like, yeah. And also, they created a ripple that is continuing to move through society in a way that we don't even know where it's going to go. Mm-hmm. That to me is a grand miracle. And definitely would rather have one Sharon Salzberg than a trillion chocolate potatoes.
Thank you.
Oh, an infinite number, a sea of chocolate potatoes. Sharon, thank you so much for giving me your time. I'm very grateful to you, and this is, these moments are really special to me, and thank you very much.
Thank you so much, and I can't wait to see you and hold the baby.
Oh, I cannot wait. I can't wait for the spring. And I'm going to be, this time I'm doing the challenge.
All right.
I'm joining in this time. I signed up last time. I didn't pull it off. This time is different. But could you please tell the listeners or the watchers potentially where they can find you and how they can connect with you?
Yeah, well, the website is just SharonSalzberg.com. And all the information about the challenge should be very prominent on there. We're going to start February 1st. And I think there's a little leeway if you want to start a little bit later, but it does start. And so, and really, it's a beautiful strength and community kind of exercise, and people get a lot out of it. So I'm really happy it's time rolling around again.
Me too. And I'll see you real soon. Sharon, thank you so much. Hare Krishna. Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye. That was Sharon Salzberg, everybody. You can find her at SharonSalzberg.com. Much thanks to Blue Chew and Robinhood for sponsoring this episode of the DTFH. And if you enjoy this podcast, won't you do me the great honor of subscribing and liking and faving and clicking and clicking? I'll see you next week. We got a wonderful episode coming up with Kyle Kingsbury. Until then, Hare Krishna.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.